Massenfeld. I'm one of the co-founders of GiveWell. I just want to give a kind of a brief plan of what we're planning to do tonight. We really want to talk about two main topics. One, we want to give an update on how charities that we've directed significant money to over the last couple of years, how they're doing this year, and what is an update on their progress. And then we also want to talk about our plans for research this year, including discussing GiveWell Labs, which is our new initiative. The way things are going to run is for both of those parts, Holden and I are going to give a real quick introduction, and then we just want to open it up for any questions that you have. We want the whole thing to run about an hour, and then all of GiveWell staff will stick around, and we're happy to answer questions one-on-one or chat further if you want. One of GiveWell's key values is transparency, and you know we want to be open about everything that goes into our research, our reasoning, and our process. And so, you know, in line with that, we're planning to record this meeting. I don't think most people are going to show up on the recording other than Holden and me, because we're recording on our phones. But if you do say something that you'd rather not go up online, just let us know and we can cut it from the audio. That's not a problem. So before moving on to other things, I just wanted to go around and let the GiveWell staff members all introduce themselves so you just know who they are. So Holden.
I'm Holden Karnowski, co-founder.
I'm Alexander. I'm a research analyst. I've been around for about a year.
I'm Fred Potos, guys. Sit on the board.
I'm Stephanie Wartstrom.
I'm Natalie. I've been
for 3 years
as a research analyst.
I'm Jonah. I just started here as a research analyst.
Cool.
I'm Tom Rutledge, John on the board.
So those are all your GiveWell people. If you have questions, that's where you can go. All right, so the first thing I wanted to cover, the first half, I guess, we'll be talking about our top-rated charities from previous years and how they've done on their recent programs. So the three charities I want to discuss are the Against Malaria Foundation, or AMF, which is our current top-rated charity and was our top-rated charity at the end of last year. The Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, or SCI, which is our current number two rated charity. And then Village Reach, which was our top rated charity from the middle of 2009 through the end of, almost to the end of 2011. And these are the three groups that have received the most funding from GiveWell directed donors over our history. So first, AMF. AMF is an organization that focuses on malaria control by distributing insecticide-treated bed nets. And you know, they're our number one organization for a couple of reasons. First, we think the program they're working on is really great, bed net distribution. It's a program that it saves a lot of lives because malaria is a big killer of children. It also prevents general sickness from malaria. And there's a really strong evidence base that giving out nets prevents malaria from happening. Also, nets are really cheap. So it's a really cost-effective way to help people. And so on evidence of effectiveness and bang for your buck, this program does really well. In addition, AMF is an organization that we think is outstanding, both because it focuses on giving out bed nets in the best way. They do high-quality distributions. And they're just totally an open book. Like any question we have, they're going to share all the information about what's going well and what's going poorly. And that's something that we think is really important in a charity. We, GiveWell donors, directed a little over $2 million to AMF at the end of last year. So the way AMF works is that they are talking to countries and trying to identify countries that want to do net distributions but don't have sufficient funds to give out nets across the entire country. Recently, they just completed a distribution in the middle of February 2012 where they gave it about 250,000 nets in a district in Malawi. This was a cost to AMF of a little over $1 million. And all signs are that the distribution went pretty well. Reports that their distribution partner posted about the distribution found instances of attempted theft and fraud among the workers who were distributing the nets, but they were able to prevent them. And then they actually just sent us a couple days ago data on malaria cases in the district that they were serving. And that data shows a pretty significant drop in malaria relative to the previous year. Now, we're still trying to look into all the factors that could have caused that drop, because nets are not the only thing that could change.
But certainly the preliminary data is positive. Right now, AMF has about $4 million in the bank, and they're looking at other countries to do similar types of distributions. So the two countries they're looking at are Togo and Mali. If they do the distributions in both of those countries, it would use up all of the reserves that they have. It would take up all of that $4 million. Mali actually has a larger gap of about $7 million. And so they, you know, we do continue to think that AMF has what we call room for more funding, meaning that more money would allow them to do more BedNet distributions. And we feel comfortable with them getting, you know, up to about $15 million more to do what they're doing. Our the next charity is SCI. Their full name is the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative. What they focus on is deworming. And deworming is a program where they distribute medicine that treats parasitic infections that are very common in the developing world. Now, these infections don't kill people. They rarely hospitalize people. And some people may not know that they have them. But we think that there's, you know, a pretty strong case that treating these infections does a substantial amount of good. The treatments themselves are really cheap. It costs about 50 cents per person per year, because you take the pill once every year or once every other year. So it's an incredibly cheap intervention. SCI as an organization has a strong and long track record of collecting information and sharing it that shows that when they enter an area, infection rates are really high. When they leave the area, infection rates are really low. And that type of track record is relatively rare among charities. They get most of their funding from the UK government. And the unrestricted funding, the funding that came from GiveWell donors, makes up a small portion of their overall budget. GiveWell donors gave about $750,000 to SCI at the end of last year. But they use that funding to fill in gaps where the government funders are either not interested in certain countries or not paying for all that they have to in a particular country. And we don't have a very specific understanding of what SCI will spend more money on next, but we think their track record is such that we're confident that they're going to be spending money to do more of the same type of thing that they have done. The final organization I want to mention before moving on to questions is Village Reach. So Village Reach is an organization that does health system logistics. And what that means is that they focus on improving the distribution of needed health supplies. We recommended them starting in 2009 on the basis of a pilot program they ran in a single province in Mozambique from 2002 to 2007. And we were impressed with the evidence and recommended them, and Village Reach has now received about a little over $2 million as a result of our recommendation. And what they're working on now is scaling up this pilot project they ran in a single province of Mozambique into the rest of the country. Now, they've been doing this since 2010, and so we've been tracking the progress for, you know, since we moved a significant amount of money to them for a while, and their scale-up has really run into some pretty big struggles. One thing that's happened is in several of the provinces they've gone into, services basically just didn't run at all in a few of the months. And the reason, one of the main reasons this happened, is that they work in partnership with the Ministries of Health and other funders didn't come through and provide their portion. And so then the workers were not going to go out and run the program. A second problem, therefore, that's occurred is now Village Reach estimates higher costs to run the entire program, partially because they want to step in and provide the funding for these gaps that if the funders don't come through, Village Reach wants to come through. And so that is one factor that's increased costs. And then finally, because of these problems, they've scaled back what they intend to do, at least in their first go. Initially, they had planned to go into 8 provinces in Mozambique, which is almost the entire country, and now they're only planning to go into 4. We think it's really important to note that Village Reach deserves a lot of credit for even sharing a level of information publicly that allows us to be able to follow what they're doing, because a lot of organizations, you wouldn't even know if something went wrong. But on the basis of all that, you know, we think Village Reach might have now a funding gap where they need money. We actually removed Village Reach as our top-rated charity at the end of 2011 because at the time we didn't believe that they had a need for money in the short term. And so we took them down. Now, based on this new information, we think they probably do have a need for money in the short term, and we're still waiting on an update from Village Reach about the details of their funding gap. We're still not sure exactly how we're going to rank Village Reach on our website relative to the other two charities I mentioned, AMF and SCI, which are our current two top charities. And one of the things that, you know, we're thinking about, and we're going to write a lot more about this, but in a nutshell, when we look back at the evidence of impact in that pilot program, you know, we at the time, we were really convinced that this program had increased vaccination rates. Because the program, which was a health system logistics program, had improved the distribution of vaccines to the clinics that needed to use them. And we were, you know, at the time we thought this, the evidence that the vaccination rate had risen was reasonably attributed to Village Reach's activity. And as we've looked back and continued to vet our previous conclusions, we think that now it's possible that other players also had a major role in that happening. Maybe the government was getting more interested in improving vaccination rates, and therefore it's possibly hard to attribute the change to Village Reach. You know, this is something that's important to us, to always be looking back at the things we concluded in the past and reflecting on them and trying to figure out what we were right about and where we went wrong about. It's also the case that since we first recommended them in 2009, our standards of evidence have risen as GiveWell as an organization has matured, and applying our current standards back to them is a process where we're learning something. But you know, this is something that we're still in the middle of, and we're going to be writing a lot more about. And again, you know, we definitely still think Village Reach is an outstanding organization, both in their willingness to share information publicly, but also their collection of meaningful data that allows an outsider to follow the project and figure out whether it's working or not. So those are the three organizations I wanted to give a summary about, and now open it up for questions.
Don't be shy.
Someone has to go first, and then.
So, on Village Reach, I remember at some point there was some hope that what they were doing could potentially be a model for nationwide distribution of supplies in Mozambique. And how, you know, have those hopes dimmed given what's happened, and is the government sort of watching what they're doing and potentially, you know, learn from their work as well?
So. Tom is asking, you know, Village Reach initially had high hopes for demonstrating the model could scale, and then it could, if it worked throughout Mozambique, taking it to other countries. I mean, that hope is still there. I think the focus now is figuring out whether it can scale in Mozambique and following the progress of the project there. And so I don't think much has really changed in terms of the possible upside. And you know, that was there, it's still there, and the focus is just on how well will the program work right now. Scott?
For the amount of money that they had, how many vaccinations would you have anticipated that they would have done? And how much did it actually turn out to be in the end after all those models?
So Scott's asking about, you know, looking at how much they've spent and how the difference in increased immunizations, what's the difference relative to what we would have expected?
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, I think the real question with this program is, right now, I don't think they've done anything in the country where we would say they've likely led to a rise in immunization rate.
They're only partway through the project, that's why that is.
So it's like, where Village Reach is at, is that, you know, they ran the pilot project in a single province, and then they left in 2007, and then it basically went back to the old system. And so they came in, and now they need to get the system up and running again, and they... Last year was the first year they were really going on trying to get it up and running, and they just ran into these very basic logistical problems of, you know, getting the people who have to deliver the vaccines to be paid so that they can go and deliver them. And so I think it's fair to say that, you know, last year there was no impact of the program. It was a year that they were trying to get it going, and they failed to get it going.
But just to give a little more context, I mean, Village Reach, they don't use the money that they have to go and, like, directly do vaccinations. So they're a little bit more complicated value added than our current top charities. They, you know, what they do is they try to run a multi-year project that changes the logistics of the health system and changes the way it works. And the theory is that then, you know, a lot of things work better, and one of their measures is that immunizations go up. So at the time we recommended them, we said, if all you gave them credit for was the immunizations going up, you would still get a good cost per life saved, even though there's all this other stuff going on. They're trying to improve the efficiency of the health system, and they're trying to make that a sustainable change. But, you know, that said, the cost per immunization, you know, if you believe all the modeling and if you believe how much they make immunizations go up, that has risen a lot because they basically cut their plans in half, 4 provinces instead of 8, and that didn't make their costs go down much at all because a lot of it is kind of centralized. And so it's like, the, you know, it's a big scaling thing and they lost some economies of scale. There was also some currency fluctuations and some unanticipated costs. And so, you know, I think the like, it's something like on a per unit basis, something like 4x the projected cost now, you know, bang for the buck, 4x worse, which is, you know, disappointing. But on the other hand, really good that we know this.
So you were not really anticipating, Ellie mentioned, other funding.
Yeah.
So it just seems like it was a faulty assumption for a cost per life saved, right? You just didn't...
That's not true.
You assumed the other funding as well?
No, we did,
Because all they're doing, it seems like all they're doing now is just saying, okay, there was other funding in X, and now they're not paying that, so now we need to pay it. But really, like, if you're thinking of a cost per life saved, it doesn't make a difference between paying X, whether it's the other funding from the reach.
Right. No, we always counted all costs. Our cost per life saved was the whole deal. It was the government cost. It was everything. So that is not what changed.
So the cost per life saved that went up has nothing to do with the other funding that they need.
Right.
It's just the fact that there's...
Right. It's other things. It's currency fluctuations. It's losing economies of scale. The fact that they're paying for something that the government was paying for is, you know, shouldn't in theory affect our calculation, and it's also very small. The costs that they've taken over are very small.
Sorry, question. So what, you guys mentioned that your processes evolve for a variety of reasons, but what have you learned from this about charities and picking the top charities so far?
I guess
would be what I would guess.
So I'm just going to repeat the questions as we go, also for the sake of the recording, because the recording is also... So the question is just, what have we learned from Village Reach about how to pick top charities? So I think there's two specific things I can think of, and Holden can add some. I mean, one big thing is being more concerned than we were about other actors potentially causing the impacts that occurred. And so, you know, with Village Reach, we have, if you go to our Village Reach review and you look at it from 2009, we asked this question about, you know, what else could have caused this impact? Who else was involved in immunizations at this time? But we didn't do a lot of due diligence on that question. We accepted this paragraph from their evaluation report saying there was really no one else involved, and I think we asked them about it. But by the end of last year, I remember we were looking at some charities, and with them, the big question was, you know, can we attribute this impact to them? And we just called like 5 different people who would have known about this charity and other players who were involved in the same type of program, and they were like, no, you know, you guys have to be aware that there's a lot of other ways in which, you know, this other charity's program, so not Village Reach, but another one that we didn't ultimately recommend, could have happened, but because of other factors. And that was just a slow evolution in our process, where when we started, Village Reach was the best thing that we had found, and we hadn't thought as much about all the other ways that the effects could take place, and we've become a lot more careful about that. So that, you know, one thing we've learned is asking more about what else could have caused the impacts that you see. Another, I don't know if I'd put it like a slightly narrower thing, is just that understanding the complexities of what it takes to run a program is something that, you know, when we recommended Village Reach, we didn't have the understanding about all these other funders that needed to come in and provide funding, that it's not just Village Reach comes in, negotiates with the government, and then the program runs, and it's like 2 actors need to agree. There's also other funders, there's other organizations that get involved, and that was a complexity that we didn't foresee, and you know, now we know is there.
Yeah, it's one of those things we didn't even think to ask about. You know, it's like we kind of had this simplified model of the world in which there's a government and there's Village Reach, and it turns out the government has a lot of supporters, and the supporters want specific things. So coordinating an aid project can get very, very complicated. And so it matters a lot, like if they're able to get the momentum going, which I actually think there was good reason to think they would, but it's still something we know about now that we didn't know about before, and the reason we know about it is because we've been following things.
So just to follow up, if you ask those questions about the current top 2 charities, like how do they fit along those 2 dimensions of the complexity of the other funders and the other actors that are involved,
Yeah, I mean, the two top charities now are a lot simpler in terms of what it takes for their programs to have an impact. Like Village Reach was trying to change the way the government distributed supplies. And so that, you know, they have to then convince the government and get the government workers to behave differently. That is a really complex activity where they are partnering with all these other organizations. With, you know, the Against Malaria Foundation as an example, they buy nets. They give the nets to a partner, the partner distributes the nets, and the nets go out, and we can already see, you know, after the fact. We recommended them in December. We were trying to figure out, I mean, who else could have provided the nets, and is this going to work? And we asked all those questions, but you can already see now the nets have gone out and people have them, right? And so it's they're a simpler type of program.
I want to add a couple of things, unless this is on that. I want to add a couple of, like, lessons I'm taking away from Village Reach too. One of them is it's really good to supplement any kind of evaluation with just, like, talking to people and getting a common sense check on, you know, here's a person who knows what's going on in this area. Let's present our view of what happened and see if they agree. That's something we didn't used to do pretty much at all. And the reason for that is partly because we couldn't. So, you know, one of the things that's changed for GiveWell is we have a much better brand. We have a lot more influence. People care what we think. And we're able to get people on the phone. And, you know, maybe some of these people we could have gotten on the phone, but it was like, it was always such an ordeal to get, you know, kind of a high-up government person on the phone that we wouldn't even bother. And now it's like, it's a much more built-in part of our process. A lot of times it's the first step. It's the first thing we think about. You know, who would know what's going on? How can we check some of this stuff out and be more skeptical of the story? Another thing that I've taken away, I mean, I think back to when we originally recommended Village Reach. We recommended them, and we also recommended the Stop Tuberculosis Partnership. And for us, the difference was kind of like small-ish, or at least much smaller than I would call it today, because the Stop Tuberculosis Partnership was doing a good activity, but they had no transparency, and we had no understanding of what more funds were going to do, and we had no clear expectations, whereas Village Reach, it was like, it felt at the time like icing on the cake, like this bonus. It was really nice that we were able to get a really concrete plan about what more money was going to do. They were really good with data. We knew what data to expect. We knew that that something was wrong if we didn't get this data or if the data didn't look good. And so at the time, that felt like kind of a small point in favor of Village Reach. At least that's how I remember it. And now it just feels like essential. If you don't have these expectations, you will not find out how the project went. You will not learn. You will not improve your future research. You know, maybe at some point when you know the aid world well enough, you're ready to do that. But we have too much learning to put a small weight on that factor. So I think we got a little lucky with Village Reach that they have good data, they have clear plans, and they're transparent, and they let us share all this stuff. And that's become something that's much more, you know, we can't compromise on that going forward. And then another thing I learned was just... you know, there's this whole class of charities that I've become very much more skeptical about, which is the class that's kind of a Western innovation for the developing world. It's like a new way of running a government program. And I've more than once seen a case where they have this data, it looks good, and when you really dig on it, it's like there's always something else going on. And, you know, normally when I see a chart that's, you know, a line that looks like this, I think, okay, you know, it's flat, it went up, and it coincides with the charity, looks good. But what really happened, or what might have happened, is that the reason the charity got involved is because the government got interested in the thing the charity's doing. And a government being interested in an area is a huge factor in what happens. So even if you see this discontinuous jump that looks like it must be the charity, really, maybe not. And so, you know, we've become more skeptical of these kind of innovation things because a lot of them don't have good data at all. And even when they do, it might look like that. We feel like some of the more... you know, the more cut and dried interventions like bed nets. I mean, the evidence base is more robust, and that matters.
Can you describe what you mean by the Western
style engagement? I just mean the idea is that it's like someone who is basically.
You could like separate these like two types of charities into
right.
Seeing a program being run and trying to make that program run better. Which is what Village Reach does, and there's a whole class of charities doing that, versus AMF and SCI, which are like buying supplies that are needed that aren't there, and just using money to buy goods. And that's the distinction.
The Western staffing you're referring to is the former.
Yeah, I'm just talking about the idea of someone who's like not really like part of the situation fully, or someone who's from the West, like having a new way to do things in the developing world. And it's just like we've looked at a lot of things in that category and just feel like there's always a million factors going on. It's always hard to tell what really happened. There's always a lot of players. There's very rarely compelling data. And then when there is data, you know, it's like we've changed our mind of what constitutes compelling data for that, which is different from these kind of established global health programs.
You know, it's quite evident that a lot of your conclusions are as much qualitative as quantitative. And so, given that, I wonder, can you describe your funnel? You know, like how you evaluate charities, how they come in, how they come to your attention, and do you have a goal of, you know, raising money for just the top two? I mean, what, you know, do you to rank more on your website? I mean, what is,
right.
What is that part of what you want to do?
So the question is, given how qualitative we are and how, you know, a lot of the stuff we're saying is kind of, it's not numbers, it's not metrics, it's kind of our judgments, that raises a question. How do we choose charities? And are we just trying to raise money for a couple charities? And the answer, you know, a high-level answer, and I also think we should talk about our process, and, you know, but a high-level answer is that we don't try to be objective, we try to be transparent. And that's something that we think sets us apart. So we're not, we think that if you try to reduce everything to a set of systemized, quantified metrics that is applied exactly the same in all cases, the charity world just isn't there. The data is not standardized enough. It's not meaningful enough. You will not do a good job giving. So however objective you are, you've just done a poor job. And so we really spend the year asking, where would we give as humans, as individuals? And we're trying to show how we did it. Now, on the showing how we did it side and on the being systematic, we put a ton of effort into that. We've written that all up. And I also answered your other question, which is it just a couple charities? It kind of is. It's you know, it takes so much work to understand one charity, as you're hearing, that it really comes to, we want to help the people who want to do as much good as possible. And to try and find 20 great charities would be a distraction from that.
Yeah, so maybe, on the process thing, if you go to our website, you know, you can click any of the, I don't know, roughly 1,000 organizations that we've considered and understand the process through which we either decided on their recommending them or where they dropped out of the process and what the process was to reach that point. And the high level thing is going from a very wide number of organizations and narrowing it down to the ones that seem like they're worth the intensive due diligence.
But a lot of what you must be doing is looking at a lot of charities that you reject. And I'm wondering how they come to your attention in the first place.
We cast the net as wide as we can, or at least that's what we have done.
It's not like there's a yellow book.
Well, there is sort of, a yellow, so we focused over the last few years very heavily on international aid, and international charities all get a certain classification. And, you know, at times we've just downloaded all the tax forms that for charities that have this classification and then looked at all of their websites. Any charity that's recommended by, you know, an academic we respect who works in it, we'll take a look at them. I mean, we just want to build up that. We've gone to the Gates Foundation, looked at all of their grantees, right? We just want to start with a huge list and then figure out a way to narrow that list down to the ones that seem like they're the best.
So if a charity goes from number one to number three, is that actually direct money?
Yeah, I mean, so the question is about how changes in our rankings affect the money that goes to the charity. And, you know, what we have seen is that our top charity tends to get the lion's share of the donations that come as a result of our recommendation. When Village Reach was our number one charity at the end of 2010, they got most of the money. And when they moved off the list last year, because we thought they had run out of room for more funding, AMF went to number one, and then they got most of the money.
Although SCI got a lot, too. So a lot of it's framing. Right now on our website, it's like one, two, very prominent. And then there's kind of a break, and it has six standouts. So the one and the two both got a lot of money. The one got more than the two. So it's, and we're aware of these things, and we try to frame things visually so that they match what we actually think and what we, you know, what we think should happen. So that's partly what we're going for.
So just going back to Village Reach, the scaled up program with four provinces, it wasn't clear on whether, has that started? Is it already funded? And given your revised cost estimates, do you still think it's a good program relative to something like AMF, or how good relative to other similar charities?
Right. Okay, so the question is about the current status of Village Reach's program and where we see them relative to AMF. So the program is running in those provinces. I don't remember if it's in three or all four right now, but, you know, it's been running. You know, they we think they're going to need funding to, just for the sake of those four provinces in the relatively near future, though we don't totally know, and we're waiting on getting the details about that from Village Reach. And it's really hard to say, you know, where they'll rank relative to AMF. My gut says that we're going to feel better about AMF. There is this like flip side to the question, which is, you know, one important factor is that they've been very public about what has gone well and what has gone poorly. And that is very rare among charities. And we wouldn't want to create a disincentive for charities to share information. And so we may, I mean, we don't know what we're going to do, but one of the things we may want to encourage donors to do is fund them in some way. Because if you don't, then you create this deterrent to other charities being willing to share information. Because this is the thing they're always so frightened about. If we share information and donors actually know how the programs work out, then we'll lose all our funding. And really, it's important that charities continue to share.
I would go a little further than that. I mean, I wouldn't quite frame it as like if they don't get money, then it's a disincentive. I mean, I think what Village Reach is doing right now with, you know, in partnership with GiveWell is like revolutionary, and I think it should be rewarded in like a big way. Even if they're, you know, even if all it is that their project totally failed, which is not the case right now. But let's say their project totally failed, and what they need more money for is to kind of like start over from scratch. Even then, I see a tremendous amount of long-term value in saying, you know, this is revolutionary, this is different, this is someone being totally honest with the world about how things are going. We need to like hold that up and say, this is really good, we need more of this. So I think there's a lot of value just in that. I also think Village Reach, you know, still there's arguments that their program is a good cost effectiveness buy, and there's arguments that it isn't, and I think we don't know exactly where those stand yet.
I mean, one very high level thing is I think we've learned a lot more from following Village Reach's progress the last year and a half than we do in our research process before we fund a charity.
Right.
So we want to create more situations where we and other donors can learn from the things they fund and figure out whether they're choosing charities well.
Right. Other people can learn from this too. I mean, it's such a, the externalities are pretty big, I think. So there's
Scott.
A benefit there.
Scott?
You guys had gone to India for a little bit before, and I remember seeing on your website a while ago that you guys went to Africa and I think visited down in Mozambique. Do you think that if you've been on the ground for 2 to 3 months that you might have kind of more fully understood the situation and might have kind of caught some of the hiccups? And if so, do you think that could be kind of something when you're really focusing just on one or two organizations that you're going to recommend, do you think it makes sense to have, especially as your staff gets bigger, to have someone on the ground there for an extended period of time to really suss it out?
It's hard to know. A lot of the biggest value of the site visits, honestly, is just spending a lot of time talking to people, which is, you know, in some ways, it's like if we could get someone to just schedule a 25-hour phone call with us,
mm-hmm.
Maybe it would, but you can't. So a lot of the value, and
it's
a lot
really
of
strange that no one
yeah,
wants to do a 25
yeah, no,
hour
we've
visit.
Asked, but a lot of the value of another part of the value of the site visits is talking to like other people who are involved, so government people has been really interesting, and so you know these are things I'm not sure whether you would there would be returns to doing more of them. It's just a capacity issue. So
I don't think the being on the ground is the particular thing. I think being more. Having more capacity to put more time into the organizations that we recommend most highly is something that is
right.
helpful
and
right. has been an evolution at GiveWell over the last few years. When we recommended Village Reach, the first time we had never visited them. We had spent time talking to them, but nothing like the amount of time we spend investigating the charities we recommend today. And probably that will pale relative to the charities and programs we'll recommend in the future. Because as we learn more about what can go wrong and we have more questions to ask. Mm-hmm. And increasing the level of investigation in general, whether or not it's on the ground, that is very high value.
Right.
And I think
yeah, so. I'm just thinking that sometimes, you know, it sounded like any of us here, like you don't, when you guys went into there, you didn't know what you didn't know.
Right.
And if you're, that's one of the things where just being on the ground, you kind of find out the things you don't know. You can kind of travel around with the people that are actually delivering the vaccines to see what kind of roadblocks they run into, and then try to ferret out what's causing it. Just throwing it out there because it seems as if it might have been able to help.
Yeah, I mean, we do. That is now a part of our process. You know, last year, before we recommended AMF and SCI, we visited them beforehand to go through that exact process. So I don't know, maybe we'll come back in a few years and say, yeah, we need to spend 2 months on the ground. But I mean, we've moved in the direction of more time trying to take steps that will help us find questions we didn't know we had.
Have you ever used the bandit?
Yeah. It worked really well. It wasn't insecticide treated, though.
I have a sort of a different related question. So as you guys get bigger and you're getting more donors and you're sort of getting more well-known, like, how are you thinking about, marketing is probably not the right word, but really getting your brand out there even more now that you're more established? And, you know, obviously it's going to help the charities, it's going to help you guys, and it's really going to help everything the more, you know, well-known you are.
So the question is about our plans for outreach and marketing. I mean, we have, you know, I think thankfully had pretty good success on outreach. So our, you know, our growth in the number of donors and web visits and the dollars that go through our website has been good. And this year we continue to have, you know, some pretty good opportunities to meet with donors and meet new people that could give significant amount of funding. And so now it's pretty similar to what our plan has been for a long time, which is take like really incredible outreach opportunities when they present themselves, but largely just try to do the best research possible and have the product stand on its own 2 feet, because that has been the thing that has gotten us all of the success over the last few years. All right, I think we should pause and move on to the next topic.
Okay.
And then, you know, we'll have more questions afterwards, whatever.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about GiveWell Labs, and I think maybe I'll do the part besides your part first, and we'll pause maybe. Or do you want to just do it all? All right. Anyway. Okay. So GiveWell Labs. So GiveWell top the traditional GiveWell thing, and how we started is we started by saying we want to serve people who are looking to give, you know, a few thousand dollars, maybe $100,000, but basically they're trying to give some money. They're looking for a great charity that will use their money to help people directly, get a good bang for the buck. And what's happened over time is that I think we have accumulated an audience of those people, but we've also started bringing in people who are more interested in, you know, being major philanthropists, people who may have like very high net worth and want to just start their own foundation and do things very differently. And, you know, there's a lot of different reasons for this, but those people tend to take a different approach and want different things from their giving. It's not how can I get my money to help people directly. It's how can I do something that may have high risks but could really have huge rewards. Or how can I take the organizations, the top charities that should exist but don't, and create them, right? You have a lot more options when you give that way. So that's kind of the easiest way, I think, to think of GiveWell Labs. GiveWell Labs is basically us kind of, in a sense, starting over and saying, how would I go at this question of how to give if we were talking about hefty amounts and we were really open to anything? We could fund projects, we could create charities, there's kind of no rules. And GiveWell Labs is sort of, conceptually, we've been saying it's 25% of our research time. I think it's gonna turn out to be a lot more, partly because a lot of it overlaps heavily with the top charity stuff, in that we're trying to use GiveWell Labs to sort of take groups that are almost top charities and maybe turn them into top charities. So the thing I'm going to talk about with what we're doing, you know, we announced this last year, and we've been working on it for a few months now, and I'm just going to describe where we've come so far and what we're doing. And we're moving kind of slowly. We want to be really systematic and thoughtful. One of the reasons that we're moving slowly is because when we step back and think about how to do good philanthropy and how to do good large-scale giving, it's occurred to us that there's arguably the most important decision you make is the first decision you make, which is what causes am I interested in? And that decision, I think, is not only potentially the most important decision, but also the decision that other major philanthropists are least thoughtful about. And so when we talk to major foundations, big givers, a lot of them are pretty intelligent about, once they pick the cause of malaria control, how they go about finding the best malaria control. But if you ask why malaria, it's like, well, that's what I'm passionate about. And we think there may be a better answer than that. And so what we've wanted to do is make sure that we're really deliberate and as thoughtful as we can possibly be about picking our causes. And so we've kind of done our first round of that. And now we have a set of causes that we think are promising, and now we're going to investigate those causes, but also have this constant option to pull back and redo our causes. So we've got this set of causes, this set of problems or program areas that we think is interesting, promising, what we would guess are the most promising program areas, and then we're going to work on them, talk to them, talk within them, talk to people within them, investigate them, and to the extent that we're learning new things, we reserve the option to pull back and say, no, now we want to do different program areas. For that reason, it could be a while before GiveWell Labs reaches a lot of concrete giving recommendations, but we think it's worth it because we really want to get that problem right. So that's where we are right now, is we've basically just come up with the list, the preliminary list of causes. It's kind of a hypothesis is the best way to think of it. It's we're putting it out there so that we can get feedback on it, so that we can investigate it, so that we can work with it. We're not announcing these to be like the best five causes in the world. And we sent out a preview blog post, and the blog post actually went up today on what those causes are and why. So to be pretty quick about it, first off, just a couple of the inputs into this process. We did some work to review the history of philanthropy. There's not much good information that we found on this. We kind of looked at the best looking thing we found, which was 100 success stories, and I didn't think it was like a great, it wasn't very well done, but there was 100 distinct episodes, and so there was at least some opportunity to make a little spreadsheet and do some, you know, some pattern analysis and see if you could see any patterns. So we did that, and then we also put a lot of time into figuring out what do foundations do today. And that seems very important, because if you get a really good picture of what foundations do today, you know two things. One, you get a lot of ideas for what causes are and what they look like, and you know which are the ones that are popular, and that could lead you to good causes. Two, maybe there's an argument for staying away from the ones that are kind of really popular and everyone's doing them, and maybe there's an argument for being interested in the ones that nobody seems to be working on or that not as many foundations seem to be working on. So we've published all the details on how we did that. We used two different data sets to look at what foundations are working on. Took a lot of time and kind of, you know, I think have a pretty good picture. And we've also been thinking about what makes a good cause and what seems like a good cause. And I'm not going to say that we've done this as systematically as could possibly be done, but we did it as systematically as we could in the time we had. And now we have something. So the causes that we have, one is global health and nutrition. This is just something that we have arrived at this cause as being kind of the most promising cause to us within the category of getting your money to kind of directly help people in need. And we've written a lot about why that is, and you know we've kind of got a history of evolving toward that. So when we started, we had US and international, then we were international. Now we're kind of saying global health and nutrition, that's our best bet for how to get your dollars to cost effectively help people in need. And then we're gonna talk a little more about how we're using the GiveWell Labs framework to do global health and nutrition differently, and perhaps to create top charities instead of just to find them. And then other causes we're doing, you know, we think basically this is a huge one. This is almost like too big to call a cause, but it's scientific research. But it's something that, you know, a good number of foundations do, but it's not the most popular cause by any means. We do think it's the cause where you see the most impressive success stories in foundations history. Especially biomedical research. And so what we're basically saying now, it's not that we have any particular, you know, any particular field within research, and we know that we're going to have to pick some, but we're going to try and get a lay of the land. What are all the fields that are out there? What are the ones that philanthropy is most heavily invested in? And where are the opportunities? And I think we have to start learning about how to evaluate long-term research opportunities. They're totally different from the charities we've done before, but a lot of philanthropy is based on this stuff, and we really need to understand it. So that could be kind of a long process, but I think it's important for us to do it, and I think it's a very, broadly, I would expect a lot of philanthropy's best stuff to be within scientific research, and obviously you have to narrow it down a lot from there. Another cause that we have is called what we call meta-research. So the idea there, this is basically a cause that we sort of made up. You know, I think there's people working on it, but I have never seen a foundation that says we have a cause called meta research. And what this is basically started, we used to do this work on, I mean, we still do this work, finding top charities. As we do it, we notice a lot of problems with the way research seems to be conducted. And those problems seem to relate to the incentives for academics. And so, you know, this is something that the more we talk to people, the more we hear kind of basic agreement on these points, that there's a lot of things that would be really helpful to humanity that the academic system and the government funding of academic system does not provide incentives to do. In the social sciences, that includes replication. So there's a study, but can we kind of do the same study again to try and get some more validity behind it? This idea of pre-registration, which is announcing in advance things like what your hypothesis is, so that when you publish, it's kind of more credible. It doesn't look like you fished around for something interesting in your data. Open data, publishing all your data in code so that other people can engage with it. And then finally, you know, this broader question of, are the things that are rewarded in academia the most helpful studies to humanity? Or is there a systematic disconnect that we can do something about? So meta-research is the idea of trying to fix the system instead of just fund the research. Meta-research is the idea of trying to improve incentives and take parts of the system and make them reward the most healthy behavior. It's very ambitious. It could be very long-term. It's certainly the opposite of like a proven intervention. What we like about this cause is that you can see the massive upside. If you got even some traction on improving incentives, there's a huge amount of money going into research. Research is incredibly important. You could have an enormous impact. It kind of seems worth a shot, and it doesn't look like any other foundation is looking at things this way. So that's why we think that's an interesting cause. We kind of had our first interview with a charity that kind of belongs squarely in this cause, and they kind of said, well, nobody funds meta research, so nobody funds us, and so that's something we can get into if later people are interested. But that was interesting. And then another cause that we're interested in is what we call global catastrophic risks, or GCRs, and there's this basic idea that there are some things that probably won't happen, but if they happen, they would be like globally catastrophic, and therefore there's kind of no one else who's position to work on them except philanthropy. I mean, maybe government, but maybe there's room for improvement in the way the government is preparing for them. You know, and this is based on our kind of analysis of what makes a good philanthropic cause, which we've written about, but we like things where it's kind of hard to think of anyone else who would have an incentive to address this problem except for big foundations or philanthropists. So global catastrophic risks include climate change. That's something that a lot of people want to know about. That's something that we're looking into, and we could talk about how we're doing on that. They also include things that are, you know, a little bit wackier, but that I think are worth looking into, partially because no one else is, or few others are. So there's nuclear proliferation risks. I think there's a couple foundations working on it, but not many. There's this idea of kind of bioterrorism. How bad could that get? I've seen one group working on it. We're going to talk to them, but only one. So, you know, and then there's even more speculative. I mean, just the general acceleration of technology, where are the places that are most likely, where you're most likely to see something really scary come up, and is there anything you could do in advance? So those are, you know, that cause is, it's not zero foundations working on it, but it's a very small number. And we were able to confirm that because it's kind of neatly separated out in the data. And then a final word is that one of the areas we're totally ignoring right now kind of is policy advocacy, trying to kind of change laws and advocate. That's just something I think it's going to be a long time before we get to it, but we're kind of doing some preliminary, just trying to talk to people who know the area and get a basic grounding so that at some point we'll be able to do it, because that's what a lot of philanthropy does, and it could raise brand problems for GiveWell, but I think we have to know about it, we have to have a view on it, and we'll see where we go from there.
So that's the whole GiveWell Labs, but GiveWell Labs is a part of our research process. There's still the part where we're just trying to find more great charities along the lines of AMF and SCI and Village Reach. You know, last year when we did this, we were focused on talking to lots of different types of charities working in international aid, and this year we're much more focused just on global health and nutrition. So we're looking at things like vaccines, tuberculosis, nutrition, neglected tropical diseases. You know, we think it's possible that we're not going to find new top charities this year. And, you know, partially that's because AMF and SCI, our two top charities now, are really both great. They work on great programs. They're both transparent about what they do. We can follow their success and see whether it works, and meeting that standard is hard. It wouldn't be the end of the world, since we think both have a lot of room for more funding. I mean, they can take in a lot more money and do a lot of good work. But one of the things that, you know, labs might help us do is not just is to create these new charities that can then meet the standard of AMF and SCI. And Holden mentioned that. And so one example is there's this organization, the Measles Initiative, and they focus on measles immunization campaigns. And they may deserve a lot of the credit for the really large drop in measles deaths in the developing world over the last decade, from about a million a year in the year 2000 to closer to 200,000, you know, now. And, you know, if they run a great campaign, they might end up being a top charity. But maybe we'll find out that they're an organization that just doesn't meet the standard for sharing information or evaluation that we need. And then we can use labs as an opportunity to create a new top charity, help them, fund them to do the things that they would need to do to meet the standard, and that creates a new vehicle for donors to just give money to, you know, another outstanding charity. And so that, you know, that's another thing you may think. So with that, open it up for more questions.
It seems like one of the premises of GiveWell Labs is that you can create top charities, that, you know, if you've identified something that's effective, you can somehow create a vehicle to do it. Do you have any thoughts about how you're going to do that? Because it sounds like something really new for you.
I mean, I think the ideal hierarchy for me for any giving is, you know, first best, the best thing that could ever happen is that there's already someone who is better at what you want to do than you could ever be, and you just write them a check with no strings attached. And that's what we've been, that's what we've always done, that's always what our top charities are. That's certainly how I would describe AMF. I think, you know, feel really good just writing them a check. And then there's like one level down that might be a group that has 90% of it together, and maybe they're not so good on transparency. I mean, one of the reasons I think it's pretty like possible that we won't find another top charity this year is that transparency has become more and more important to us over time, because of all these issues about how important it is to follow the project and learn how it goes, and you know how hard it seems to improve and get traction if you don't have that. And also, I think we've also come to conclusions that, you know, transparency says certain things about the attitude of the organization, the people running it that we care about and that we think would lead to better results. So, you know, maybe there's an organization that's missing that. So do you want to fund them and say, as a condition of this funding, things are going to get more transparent? Is that something that's going to work, or is that something that kind of, you know, you're micromanaging and it's going to go badly? Well, we don't really know yet. We know that a lot of foundations do restricted funding and funding with conditions, so it's worth a shot. The worst thing that you could do, and the thing that you really want to avoid doing, is saying, like, there's no organization working on this at all. Let's create it out of whole cloth. Like, let's basically find the people who would be logical to work on it and recruit them and, you know, create this organization. I don't like the idea of it. It seems really hard. On the other hand, it's definitely done. Foundations definitely do it. The Gates Foundation has done it multiple times, and I think in some cases it's gone really well, and it's worked out great. So I wouldn't rule that out at all, and obviously it's something that we're not experienced with or comfortable with, so it's going to be a learning process. That's why GiveWell Labs is 25%. I think there's a ton for us to learn. I think it would be a huge mistake not to work on that, learn it over time, but we're not in a rush to recommend things until we understand them well, and we have our top charities until then.
Are you on the radar, and have you had dialogue with some of the more well-known charities about your methods and what they would need to do to become a top charity, or at least be in your analysis?
Yeah, the question is, are we on the radar of top charities, and have we made it clear to them what it takes to become a top charity? I think the answer is largely yes. Maybe not 100%, but I think by now, most of the charities that we would be interested in know about us and know what we want. And that's part of the reason that I think it's pretty decent chance we won't find more top charities, because I feel like we would have heard from them. I mean, they would have come, you know. We'll see, though. We're open to it.
How is GiveWell funded?
So the question is, how is GiveWell funded? GiveWell itself is a nonprofit, and there are donors who pay for GiveWell's operation, which lets us put the research out there for free. And so those donors are, you know, both some institutions fund us. The Hewlett Foundation has a program of improving philanthropic information. They fund GiveWell. And then also donors who are very close to the project, who have, you know us, have followed the project over time, really value the research, and then they provide some of the funding for
the way that we run that is that we're always asking for people to give to our top charities, not to us. And it's only the people where it's like we really, you know, we feel like they really get GiveWell, they like GiveWell, they want it to exist, and the relationship is comfortable, that we would ask for operating support. And we try and not ask for more operating support than we need. And so, you know, the way that it works is that the people who support us directly, in a sense, are kind of making it possible for us to not have to raise money from others. And then those others' money goes to top charities instead, but also it's like easier for us to have a good relationship with them because we're not asking them for money.
I mean, one thing that's nice is giving to GiveWell's top charities and letting GiveWell know and the charities know that it was GiveWell that caused you to give to the top charities helps us a lot in our mission, because it makes the incentive for charities to engage with GiveWell larger. And so, you know, if someone goes and gives money to AMF and that increases the total money moved that's coming from GiveWell. Well, now all of a sudden we have easier access to charities and experts, and that makes everything run more smoothly. And so that, you know, that helps us too, and we're really happy when that happens.
On that, why do you ask people to give to the charity directly instead of giving it to you, and then you deliver this big check to AMF?
So the question is, why do we ask people to give to AMF directly as opposed to through us? I mean, you know, something that may change over time. When we started, we just said, hey, this is an extra headache of asking people who don't know us to give us money and have it go into our bank account. Why not just have them give right to the charity? The only thing that mattered to us was being able to track funds. And so as long as we can track it, which we can, then it's good enough.
On
the GiveWell
Labs choices and causes, can you describe maybe pretty briefly like what the ethical framework there is? Like you use a word like doing the most good.
Right.
So
yeah.
I assume you guys thought about what that means, and maybe
yeah.
talk about like how you got to the criteria for evaluating these funds.
Yeah, so the question is, what's the framework or the overarching value system within which we're, you know, saying we want to, what does it mean when we say we want to do the most good? The answer is we don't fully know. It's, you know, it's purposely vague because we feel like we will do more good if we don't define good narrowly. We'll have more options to pick from. You know, there are some things we can say. I mean, we're humanitarian is a good description of the values. We're trying to help humans have better lives, in some cases have lives, you know, save their lives. Those are things we're trying to do, so there's a lot of things that don't fall into that category. It's also global humanitarian, so we're not preferring any particular, you know, nation or any particular background of humans over another. They're all just humans. All lives have equal value is the Gates Foundation motto. We agree with that. So those are a couple things that we can say. We do have a lot of internal discussion about like how it breaks down in the details of that. You know, would you rather, some of us are more, and actually Natalie wrote a blog post about this. I mean, Natalie, compared to me, Natalie is more interested in reducing suffering. I am more interested in kind of what I would call empowerment, or, you know, helping people be everything that they could be. But these don't tend to matter very much in practice. And so what we've tried to do is kind of define it in the way we need to define it, so that we can do our investigations and do our work, and usually we don't need to resolve this to decide which charity to give to, but at the point where we did, we would be transparent about that too, and we would discuss it and why we prefer this and whether you might want to give here instead if you disagree.
So, in order to qualify as a kind of outstanding charity, charities need to be unusually transparent. You agreed like the number of charities that would even qualify to be looked at and vetted by GiveWell is pretty narrow because of that criteria. So I understand why that criteria is necessary, but I'm kind of wondering how, you know, what does that mean for you? What's your feeling? Do you feel that this kind of strict criterion for transparency, this call for extreme transparency, makes a lot of good work kind of fall off your table, and just you being unable
right.
to recommend it?
So the,
or
yeah.
does good transparency kind of come with doing good work?
So the question is, are we leaving a lot of good opportunities on the table by having very high standards for transparency? The first answer I'd give is we're not absolutist about it. So if we saw a group that was amazingly good and they weren't transparent at all, they would have to be enough better, right? If they were going to be ranked above AMF, they would have to be enough better than AMF to outweigh that transparency deficit. And that's hard to do because bed nets are really, I mean, one of the most cost-effective interventions that you can find. And so in a lot of ways, it's like we're having high standards because we can. We're being a little bit demanding because we have top charities, and so in order to beat them, you know, you need a certain level. But it's possible, and we're open to it. And so it's not the first requirement. It's not the only requirement. We think it's an important one. We think that transparency probably correlates with other good things, like being in this for the right reasons, and like being self-critical enough and interested enough in feedback and in self-improvement to kind of deal with this very difficult situation where if you don't impose the feedback loops on yourself, you won't have them. You won't be able to improve over time. So, and we've also found that empirically, it's just like we offer lots of charities, hey, we'll talk with you. And if at the end of the process you don't want us to publish anything, we won't. And if we decide you're good, we can negotiate about what to publish. And it just happens that the ones that are the best are also the ones that are open book. Now, there's a factor of engagement with us, right? There's the ones who ignore us, but that factor also, I think, correlates with things, especially like need for money. You know, the willingness to engage with us, and the willingness to engage with us has gone up a lot, so it doesn't vary as much as it used to, I don't think, though it still varies. So I actually don't think we're leaving a lot of good on the table, and I think we're, if we ever felt that we were, we would just recommend a charity, despite the lack of transparency.
And it just depends, like, there was a time when public transparency was an initial heuristic we used in our process, and charities would drop out because they weren't posting a lot of information on their website. And that, you know, that could have led us at the time to miss things, but now that's not a major initial point in the process. If we go to a charity, then we ask them to share information with us. If they won't share information with us, well, then we frankly can't figure out whether they're good or not. And I think that, you know, like Holden said, an organization that was self-critical and had the information to figure out whether their programs were working or not would be at least willing to share it with us for our eyes only, if, you know, if they had collected that meaningful information.
So, if the premise of GiveWell is to basically just give to two or three top charities, as you said, is then the underlying premise that there's a sort of a cap on how much dollar donation you can actually get and therefore give out? Because after all, their ability to, or the organization's ability to absorb is only X, right? So we're pretty much saying out there that you can only get, put a number, $30 million, and that's it, and that's how much you want to continue to give every year, or how does it sort of grow?
Yeah, so the question is whether focusing on recommending a couple charities leads to a cap on the amount of money that GiveWell can ultimately direct. I don't think it does, because, you know, our goal, first of all, you have charities that can absorb large amounts of money. So right now, the two organizations we have, they together have a cap of about $30 million. But, you know, if AMF, as an example, were to receive $15 million this year, we would then expect that they could receive a lot more in the future. You know, what they do is very scalable. There's a big need for bed nets. If they could move $15 million, like that $15 million number largely comes from a feeling of how much they could grow over previous years. And if they did that well, we would think that they could direct more. So that's kind of one way to look at the question. More broadly, I mean, we are just constantly looking for more great opportunities. And we may end up finding five or six things that can be good. And those opportunities themselves could have wide ranges of how much they could take in. And so I don't think we're, you know, we don't yet feel like we are very constrained. You know, if we had a big year and a lot of money, we'd be bumping up against what we could move. But in the long run, you know, our aim is to be able to find sufficient opportunities that we can direct a lot more money.
It could turn into a challenge, but the key to note is that our target is, the number we care about is not the number of recommended charities, it's the number of dollars that we'd feel good about moving. And we'll just do whatever it takes to hit that. So right now, we feel okay that we have like two top charities, they could absorb $30 million. We know how much we're probably going to move, it's probably not going to be $30 million, so that's okay for now. In the future, if we ever are going to get to $1 billion a year, we're going to have to probably find more than two charities. I mean, you know, we're going to do whatever it takes to move all that money as well as we can. I mean, if you just think of us like a foundation, I think that's an easy way to think about this, because it's like you have a certain amount that you need to direct. You need to spend it as well as you can. You shouldn't be looking for more opportunities than you need to find, but you do need enough to absorb all those dollars.
So how are you thinking about now you have the GiveWell Labs and you have the old way, and you, as you mentioned in the beginning, you're serving two types of different types of donors to some extent.
Yeah.
So you kind of have the same people working for two slightly different goals. I know you're still trying to help people, so at the end maybe they're all the same thing. But you do have two sets of donors for different demands of your time. And then also, how do you think about yourself ultimately doing this because you're trying to accomplish a goal? So just thinking in terms of both communicating clearly in terms of what GiveWell is and what you're trying to accomplish, and then making sure that both types of donors are getting what they want. How do you think about the conflict? Like, is there much of a conflict or a competition between these two?
Right. Jason's question, is there kind of a conflict between GiveWell Labs and traditional GiveWell, and how do we make sure that all the donors are happy and they're getting their value? I mean, I think the 75-25 split is okay for now. It's basically we're putting more work into the stuff that we've made our name on and that we feel good about our ability to do, but it's also important to invest for the future. And I think the easiest way to think of GiveWell Labs on this front is as kind of R&D. I mean, you don't spend all your budget on R&D, you don't even spend a majority, but you got to spend some because you're investing for the future. And I think what GiveWell Labs is going to do, it may move a lot slower than normal GiveWell, but it means that if in 10 years we've got way more dollars that we can move, we're going to have laid the groundwork to have way better giving opportunities for those dollars and be able to absorb more of them. So I think that's a decent way of thinking about it. I think the two are also ending up helping each other a lot more than we thought. But we're basically trying to, you know, just make clear that we have that allocation and we need to make progress on both. And I don't know, it's just a budgeting thing.
Can you guys speak a little bit about how you've seen the tone of the conversation with charities change as a petition? It will also become, you know, stronger.
Right.
Yeah, so the question is how the conversation with charities has changed as our reputation has grown. I mean, it's changed a lot. We have much easier access. I think I'll give you one quick anecdote that just happened that is a good illustration. A couple of years ago, we tried to look at this charity that works on a neglected tropical disease. I remember calling them, sending them emails. We got like one email response, but scheduled a call, it never happened. And then we spoke to the same charity a couple days ago because someone associated with them reached out to us because they wanted to be reevaluated. We had a phone call, and then they just sent us, after the phone call, 100 different evaluation documents about the program. And so that's something of an extreme example, but the overall trend is much more excitement about engagement with GiveWell, and the engagement goes much more easily, and that means that we can do a lot more, a lot better, because we don't have to fight so hard to get access.
Do you also see a broader change in sort of the way people are talking about how organizations should expect to be evaluated?
It's really hard to say. The question is, do we see a broader change in the way organizations expect to be evaluated? I mean, all we can see from where we sit is that it's easier to get organizations to engage with us. Is that a broader change, or is that just us becoming, you know, a bigger deal? I don't really know.
Yeah, I mean, there's some, we see like little things, but they're all like little anecdotes. Like we have a mistakes page on our website, another charity pops up and tells us they have a mistakes page because they like
right.
that we did it. But you know, it's things like that. I mean, I think the big picture is GiveWell is still small and we're growing. And you know, I hope that we want to grow a lot more. And you know, if and when we do that, then I think there'll be more changes like that.
So, David? So what do you attribute GiveWell's growth?
So the question is, to what do we attribute GiveWell's growth? I mean, look, I think a lot of it is that we're the only ones doing what we're doing. No one else is out there investigating charities the way that we are and putting the information out in public. And we've put a lot of effort into doing it as well as possible. And for people that are interested in this, I mean, we're sort of the only game in town.
We do, I mean, Ellie mentioned this before, but we have a lot of conversations, you know, about research versus outreach, and we believe that research is our best outreach. That the success we've had has been people giving more over time because they feel better about us, people hearing about us through word of mouth, and they get a trusted referral, so they come and they give, you know, connections, networking, because people believe in what we're doing. And you know, I think that's definitely something that
I mean,
seems
it has
important.
Always been the case for us that when we've tried to do something proactive for outreach, it has not gone well. And when someone has found us and said, this is really cool and unique, and then they spread it, and that's gone really well. And so we just want to continue to be the place that someone can say, this is the best research on charities that I've ever seen.
Yeah. Another way in which research is outreach is that we blog a lot, and we get links to the blog, and that improves our search standing. And that matters a lot. That's where a lot of our traffic comes from.
So what do you think are the biggest factors that lead charities not to want to be transparent with you guys? I can imagine a number of explanations from like having internal politics such that it's not possible to produce the documents that you're talking about, to like, you know, simply not understanding the question, to like
right.
never being been asked for it before. What do you...
Yeah. So what do we attribute the... When a charity is reluctant to share information with us or with the public, why is that? There's a lot of theories. I think one of the most common things that I would bet on is that the information just doesn't exist and or is just not something that we're going to find compelling, and they know it. So, I mean, I think a lot of cases, you know, if we really go deep and we ask and we ask and we ask, we usually get something back, but it's a lot of times we see why it wasn't forthcoming in the first place. And I just think there's a lot of mundane factors that you would expect. I mean, I think a lot of these guys, they haven't been asked for this stuff before. It doesn't paint a very good picture. They're embarrassed to share it. They don't see what's in it for them because they don't think they're going to get our recommendation anyway.
I think the biggest thing with the charities we talk to is they don't have the information. And I think the reason they don't have it is that they're not being asked for it. So one story that I think illustrates this point is that I just went to talk to a pretty well-known charity, and we set the meeting for an hour. And I showed up, and the first 50 minutes of the hour was them giving me this big PowerPoint pitch about how great the charity is. And they left 10 minutes at the end for questions. Like, when we talk to a charity, I mean, we want to do the 25-hour phone call. That's the only way we're going to get the information that we need. We need to be very specific about our questions. And, you know, they wanted to engage with GiveWell because they understood very much what the potential benefit to them would be. But the way that they had planned to engage with us was by pitching us for 50 out of 60 minutes that we had. And I think that that demonstrates the type of way that most donors want to engage with most charities, which is not asking a lot of critical questions. And if you don't have the donors asking critical questions, the charities aren't going to create the information that can answer them. Sure. Let's have one, Karen, and then we'll kind of wrap up and just we'll hang around, but people can head out if they want.
When you're thinking more globally about what needs to be funded, I remember at some point some conversation with you guys that made it sound like some donors not having information is not being asked, but some of it's, you know, not having the funding and not, you know, literally having donors telling them do not go fund evaluations, do not go fund getting the data. Would you consider at all that as something, either lab related or something like that, like just literally being a source out there that says anybody who thinks they're doing something great and doesn't have the funding, we're just willing to fund whatever it takes for you to get the data to figure out if what you're really doing is good. I guess I have a picture in my head, which I don't know if it's true, of lots of people who are doing really well, want to do really great stuff, believe that it's working, but have never, you know,
right,
been able to get their hands on the resources to figure out whether they're wasting their life doing something that doesn't work.
Right. So this is this question is, have we thought about maybe using the lab's structure to fund evaluation for groups that may be doing good work, but no one else will pay for their evaluation? I think it's definitely true there's a lot of groups that may be doing good work and no one will pay for the evaluation. There's also a lot of groups doing maybe good work and they're doing terrible evaluation, which is a horrible waste of everyone's time and money, and it would be much better if they didn't do it. This is a tough one. Like, one of the things that we have learned over time, or have our minds have changed on over time, is that we are much, like, less optimistic about the power of evaluation to improve charity over the long run. We think it's going to be different. We see different things improving charity. We see honesty, transparency, kind of more qualitative evaluation that's done in a really intelligent and thoughtful and open way, as going further. And I think what we've seen from the quantitative stuff, and the systematic stuff, it's like definitely, you know, it would be wonderful if you had the numbers and they told you the story and you could optimize to hit the numbers and then you were done. What we've seen is this hierarchy. It's like there's the groups that do nothing, then there's the groups that do something that, like, really, they really shouldn't have done anything. And then there's the groups that did something, you know, the kind of the Village Reach category, where it's like an unbelievably well done evaluation and yet it just, there's still too many questions and it's too complicated and you can't really draw anything from it, or you can't draw enough from it to make it worth all the, not only money, but creative effort that went into doing an evaluation that good. And I think Village Reach's evaluation, I mean, that was like real, it was really thoughtful. It wasn't just expensive, and that's what sets it apart. And then, like, a level above that is the randomized controlled trial. And those are the only evaluations, you know, that get taken all that seriously, as far as I can tell. I mean, there are some others there, you know, but it's like that general level of, like, you have a really good method of stripping out causality, because causality is so tough to isolate because everything tends to improve at once. And so that level, it's like those are somewhat promising and we've thought about funding them, but they're very expensive. They take a very long time. And even they, it's like, you always run into problems with questions with how does this generalize. And so just the returns you're getting, the amount of money that goes in, and then what you get back out in terms of knowledge, it's hard to find a place on that spectrum that looks good. My two favorite places on the spectrum are the top and the bottom. I would like to see more randomized controlled trials. I would also greatly like to see less of everything else. I think it's wasting time and money. And, you know, I think that there's another path forward, a couple other paths forward. One is to do strategic cause selection, to say, hey, we got to do the things where we can be really confident in this without having the numbers, or we can get the numbers. Like BedNets, the numbers work. It's easier to get meaningful data, and that matters. That helps you optimize, and that helps you get maximum cost effectiveness, and that helps you know whether what you're doing is working. And then another path is just, I feel like a lot of evaluations, it's like, if they were done in a way that was more qualitative, but more more kind of like someone says in advance what they're going to do and what their methods are and what their criteria are, and you know, you can really compare what came out after to what came out before, and the people are like doing it because they really, really want to know and they really doubt themselves. That's the kind of evaluation that I think has some potential, could be more interesting going forward. We don't see much of that. Most of the evaluations we see are someone wanting to prove that their program works. And when you're trying to do that, it's really hard to trust that stuff. And it comes out in the study. Like, you can see it in the study that that's what they were going for. So, yeah. Other thoughts on that?
No, it's fine. All right, so let's, I think we'll end the kind of formal Q&A. But, I mean, we're happy, GiveWell staff people are happy to hang around and answer any other questions if you have them one-on-one. So.